coming out of the transmitter, and it's going through a system which eventually results in that wave that you're generating being propagated through space. So what is that system? That radiating system, that electromagnetic transducing system, starts off with the transmitter. Almost everybody will keep the transmitter out of the equation. But then when it comes to the radiating system, almost nobody beyond 1900, when we used to put our ham shack in the third floor of a wooden house, and the transmitter that we built with our own hands sat on the table, the wooden table in front of us, and we were at the center of the dipole. One half of the dipole went out the eastern window of the third floor of the wooden house, and the other half of the dipole went out the western window. In those days, yes, you really understood where was the antenna and where was the transmitter, and the two came together on that wooden table. And here we are in the modern day, where very few of us are relegated to the attic, where it's hot, not air-conditioned, that's where people store all the junk, it's dusty, and whatever. Almost all of us now have the ham shack in the living quarters of the house, in the bedroom, in the closet, in the basement, and so the antenna ain't where the transmitter is. And in between, you're going to put a transmission line that conveys that valuable radio signal out of the transmitter up to the antenna. And in between, if you like, you can put an antenna tuner, a matchbox, a Viswire eliminator, call it whatever you like. But everything after you've left the transmitter is the radiating system. You didn't put the transmission line there for any other reason than to feed a signal to the antenna. And if you're not careful with the bounding device that you put at the interface between the transmission line and the antenna, if you don't put a big bounding device there, a substantial amount of the RF current that flows on the antenna will flow also on the outside of your coax cable of your transmission line. And it's radiating a signal. Is the transmission line an antenna? Yea, verily. It might be radiating 40% of your power. So, if you're really smart, you realize we're into semantics here. The radiating system consists of everything beyond the transmitter. It's all associated with converting that signal from an electronic signal inside of a shielded structure until it is a radiating signal in space. So, now, once you accept that, and once you accept the fact that an antenna of any finite size that we're likely to use 98% of the time, I'm only eliminating the antennas that are a zillion wavelengths long, beverage and rhombic. The antennas that are, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 wavelengths long. If I don't use those, and if you don't have 15 acres of property, you're not likely to use those. So if I eliminate those antennas, virtually every antenna you touch has a huge standing wave ratio in the antenna itself. That signal you've launched onto your dipole bounces back and forth roughly 30 times on that dipole before it finally gets radiated into space. I could, if I wanted to split hairs, say that even the thing you call antenna, which is operating with something like a 30-to-1 standing wave ratio, it is a kind of transmission line that is leaky, and it leaks some of that signal into space. So you can go both ways. I can push the antenna all the way down through the transmission line and the antenna tuner, or I can push the transmission line all the way through most of the thing that you call antenna, and I can make a case either way. The smart guy will say, hey, we're splitting hairs here. It is a radiating system. You talk to Irv Maxwell, W2DU, or Walt Maxwell, who did a beautiful job of designing the antenna on the Tyros weather satellite of RCA Astro Division, where he did the antenna tuning at the transmitter, because the antenna itself was out in space as a tape dipole, and he couldn't go out there and put a survivable antenna structure that would tune that high standing wave ratio out there. He tuned it at the other end of the transmission line. And some of the naive engineers he worked with said, hey, Walt, that's not going to work. He says, well, I recommend you hold back on your decision on that. Wait till we put it into the antenna testing chamber, and you see how well it works. He did all of the antenna tuning at the transmitter, at the other end of the feed line. I'll admit that his feed line was only a foot and a half long, inside of that satellite. But he didn't match the antenna at the antenna. He matched it at the transmitter. And once they measured the efficiency of the thing, they said, holy cow, it's working. How the hell did you do that? To which he said, I've been a ham radio operator for a whole lot of years. I've done the tuning in the shack as long as my feed line is low enough and large. I've been doing it for 30 years. Why can't I do it on this satellite? He did. It worked. Case closed. So once you recognize the fact that radiation doesn't take place easily, you have to kick that signal in the tail 30 times in the row. It bounces back and forth on that signal. And what you and I call resonance and tuning is really making the electronic length of the antenna such that all of those bounces stay in step. If they fall out of step and they start lagging, we say we have an inductive antenna. If they start leading and getting ahead of being in step, we say it's a capacitive antenna, and it's got a lot of reactants. We all recognize those words, reactants and lead and lag. We keep forgetting about the fact what it really means. All those bounces are not staying in phase, in step. So the process by which you keep all of those bounces in step through the antenna and through the transmission line, whether you do it with an antenna tuner at the transmission line interface to the antenna, whether you do it in the middle of the transmission line, whether you do it at the interface between transmission line and transmitter, or whether you do it inside of the transmitter, is strictly up to you. It's your choice. You'll get 98% of the same performance in every one of those locations if you're smart enough and if your feed line is low enough and long. So once you're smart enough and you realize what's really going on, you don't have to split hairs. You don't have to say, hey, you're not doing it right because you're doing the tuning in the shack. Walt Maxwell, a very respected aerospace engineer, did it in the shack for a whole lot of years. Then he did it professionally at RCA Astro on the Tyro satellite, and it worked. You can tell him he did it wrong. You're wasting your breath. It worked. It flew. It's in space for decades. K2KUI. K2LIW.
Absolutely. This is K2KUI. Exactly. And basically, I can stick by a statement that the tuner tunes your antenna, as Dick just said. As Walt Maxwell did, and I used that paraphrase basically what he did, and that's how I came up with the thing. When we did that tutelage, I'll just delve into that a little bit more. We did that Smith Chart tutelage. I guess maybe I'll explain it a little bit more in depth because I see there's a number of question marks about it. And basically, this was the situation. We had a 40-meter antenna. Cut for the low end of 40 meters, the CW portion of the band, and we wanted to now move it up the band to make single sideband contact. So, what happened? This was a simple, straightforward, nice dipole. It worked quite well, and tuned very well even without a tuner, down on the low end. Now we're going to go up the band, and here comes the problem. The SWR is going up, and it's going to be intolerable, because it's going to get up to at least 3 to 1. So what do we do? Well, what do we do with the tuner? We stick the tuner in the line, and even though, you got to remember that basically the antenna, the resistance is still around 75 ohms, but since it's so far off resonance frequency that we cut the antenna to, we showed that it was 66 ohms of inductive reactance, which gave us the SWR of 3. And in order for this rig to work, we'd like to bring it down, maybe get it down to 1.0. Oh, great enough. So, at the time, we had RG8U. We specified 33 feet of wire length of coax that went between the antenna and the shack. And we stuck the tuner in. And what happened? What I'm going to do, I'm going to go step by step. If we look at the rig, with the antenna now up the band, we found that it looked like 17 ohms resistive and 2.5 ohms capacitive reactance at the time. Now, when we stuck the tuner in, the tuner had to do actually two things. We showed this on the chart. The tuner, I'll go very slow. Number one, It supplies the 2.5 ohms of inductive reactance to the cable, so now it looks purely resistive. Then it has to act as a transformer to convert the 17 ohm resistive back to 50 ohms. So, then the cable from the tuner to the amplifier now, of course, shows a SW of 1.0. But we've got to remember that the cable from the tuner to the antenna still has an SWR of 3. The tuner can't actually change that. But what it can do is tune the antenna to resonance. And I'll get into that in 1 minute. I just want to know if you remember these statements, Dick, if you want to make any kind of add to it before I go in a little further. Go ahead, please.
Yep. I've just plugged in those numbers, 17 ohms and 2.5, as I remember, capacitance. And 17 ohms resistance and 2.5 ohms capacitance. And I'm now in the process of calculating the standing wave ratio. And as I remember, it's a pretty big number. It's like 3 to 1, 4 to 1, something like that. Mel, go ahead.
So it's 17 ohms resistive and 2.5 ohms of inductive reactance. Okay. All right. So now we did, like I say, soon is going to do these two things. We're going to try to fix this up. But, as I said, the tuner can't change, actually, what is going on right after it from the shack back up to the antenna. But what does happen? Looking at from the shack, the tuner is transforming the 50 ohms of the at the shack down to 17 ohms at the tuner end of the antenna cable. So, what you're doing is taking the 2.5 ohms of inductive to the cable. Your 33 feet of cable is actually transformed to 75 ohms resistive and 66 ohms of capacitance at the antenna. So now what we're doing, we're taking the 75 ohms exactly, matching the antenna, because the 66 ohms of capacitance, it cancels the antenna 66 ohms of inductive reactance. So actually, it's making the antenna resonant. So in this case, as you see, we are transforming all these different things with the tuner. So actually, because we're bringing it back to resonance, we can actually say that the tuner is actually tunes your antenna. I hope I made that clear enough, Dick. Over.
In my mind, you did. I'll admit there's going to be some people who will not accept that. Can the antenna tuner, if it's not connected to the antenna, can it tune the antenna? I say yes, yay verily. Mel is saying yes, yay verily. Walt Maxwell is saying the same thing. They've all done it. It works. There's 3, 4, or 5 different ways of looking at what's going on. I'm going to try a slightly different approach. The antenna itself, at the low end of the band, good half-wave dipole mounted in free space, is something like 70 ohms resistance and no reactance when it's just the right length. You go to the high end of the band with the antenna starts acting in an inductive manner. You can put a dot on the Smith chart telling you what is the impedance of the antenna. You can look it up in a good book, go to the right computer program, go to the right equation for a dipole, you plug in the numbers of how long it is and what frequency you're at, and it'll tell you, in Mel's case, quite possibly it'll tell you 17 ohms of resistance and 2.5 ohms of inductive reactance. And if you're smart enough with the Smith chart, you can put that dot on the Smith chart. You draw a circle around the origin with that dot on the Smith chart, and you'll discover that you're drawing a circle of roughly 2.9, let me call it 3 to 1, almost a 3 to 1 diameter circle. And what does that circle tell you? That if you've got a feed line that's long enough, and you make a measurement every inch along that feed line, you will be somewhere on that circle you have drawn on that Smith chart. That's just the way transmission lines operate. That's what that Smith chart is plotting for you. It's showing you on that circle all the possible impedances. At the right-hand side of the circle, the impedance, the resistive component is high. At the left-hand side of the circle, the resistive component is low. At the top of the circle, it's highly capacitive, highly inductive. At the bottom of the circle, it's highly inductive. All of those values of all those ohms of resistive component and all those values of plus and minus reactive values are all demonstrated by that simple circle you drew with your compass on that Smith chart. Choose the right length of cable, the right position of that cable where you're going to open it up and make the measurement, and you'll see one of those dots of that circle, of the infinite number of dots that made of that circle. Choose the right spot along that line, and you can hang a open-circuited stub or a short-circuited stub if you're a smart enough designer, and you can cancel the reactant, and from there on down toward the transmitter, the whole system is matched. Your antenna tuner does that. Your antenna tuner, by way of you adjusting its controls, is the equivalent of a whole lot of sub-tuners in a whole lot of locations. You twist the dials the right way, or you buy an automatic antenna tuner, and it does that for you. And what is it really doing? Mel and I and Walt are saying it tunes the antenna. If you want to go one step more accurately, you're saying it's tuning the radiating system, which consists of transmission line, antenna tuner, and antenna. You're tuning that system. The signals that bounce back and forth now stay in step. They're not bouncing back and forth just on the antenna. They're also bouncing back and forth down to the transmission line some length until they hit the antenna tuner. But you are forcing them electronically to all stay in step. You and I call that resonance. We can also call it impedance matching. That's another way of looking at it. There's a third way of looking at it. Of the signal that reflects down the transmission line because there is some standing wave ratio at the end of the transmission line, the antenna is not the same impedance as the so-called surge impedance of the transmission line. It's not a 70 ohm resistor. So some signal is going to be reflected down the line. You could say the antenna tuner, when it is properly adjusted, is re-reflecting the signal back upstream, and it's doing so in such a way that the signal is reflecting back upstream is exactly in phase with the signal that the transmitter is generating at that point at this time. It's making it all come back together. It's another way of looking at it. There's a zillion ways of looking at it. However, no matter which way you want to look at it, and your choice is yours, if you cross all the T's and dot all the I's, if you do the math correct, every one of those methods of analysis will give you the same answer. You go to the Theodore Marino book on microwave transmission line techniques. He will show you how to do this. A 1950 paperback book, a gem. Guy's a genius. Worked for Sperry Gyroscope on Long Island, and he wrote a book, a good one. And he will tell you how to do it. You open up the antenna handbook of ARRL, they will teach you how to do it. You open up the radio amateur's handbook and go to the section on impedance matching devices and basic inductance and reactance of circuits, and they will tell you how to do it. You listen to Mel, and you plot along with him on your Smith chart. He will show you how to do it. You go to the right website describing how to use a Smith chart or how to do impedance matching. They will show you how to do it. I'm trying to remember the name of the book now. I can't remember it. It's a very good book that's used as a college textbook on this subject, in electrical engineering. Can't think of the name right now of the author. He will teach you how to do it. Krauss's book. Krauss has got a book on electromagnetics. He'll teach you how to do it. Chokhinov has got a book that will snow you because he went too deep into the mathematics. It's not an easy one to teach somebody, but he teaches you how to do it. So are you resonating the antenna? Yes. Are you resonating the antenna plus feed line? Yes. Are you resonating the antenna plus feed line plus transmission antenna tuner plus transmitter? Yes. You're resonating the antenna. You're resonating the radiating system. We're splitting hairs here as to whether or not the transmission line is part of the antenna. You ain't got a viable antenna without that transmission line today. Unless you are willing to put your shack in the attic of a wooden house, you're going to live with a transmission line. You don't have a viable antenna without a transmission line. So your eye can separate them. You can say, yeah, that's a piece of RG8. I'm calling that the transmission line. And that's my piece of 14-gauge household wire that I strung with egg insulators between the trees. I'm calling that the antenna. And between the two, I call that the place where I soldered them together with the W2AU ballon or whatever, or Unidella ballon. And somewhere inside of that ballon, in the dead center of it, I transition from transmission line to antenna. You can say those words if you like to. But electronically, it's damn hard to separate them. Without all those components properly connected together, you don't have a viable radiating system. These are some of my thoughts. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. I'm sure we are 100% with you and Vic on the statements that you made. And yes, you got to just remember that the antenna matches the impedance of the transmitter, and we call that basically a fancy word for the conjugate match. It's basically saying it matches the resistive component exactly, but matches the reactive component with the same amount of opposite reactance. So this eliminates the reactance entirely at the end of the cable, which makes the rig very happy. Now, another thing that I said about about transmission line length, you got to have a certain amount of cable between point A and point B. In this case, we used 33 foot of RG8. How did I choose 33 foot? That's what it took. It took 33 foot of RG8 to go from the antenna to the rig. So I can't make it, somebody, it's too long, it's too this. Well, what am I going to do? Stick the rig out the window or something? This is what I need. And I don't believe that you have to take, there's more cable, roll it up on the floor. Nah, you don't have to do all those things. Those things are ridiculous. You use the amount of feed line that you need. The line needed 33 feet long. That is needed to reach the ham shack, and that's the story. Don't listen to all that other nonsense, the different ways the cable is going to behave and everything. And another word about the tuna. When you cut an antenna, you will get it cut on that specific frequency. Yes, an antenna is resonant and everything. You'll start moving off that frequency, and that antenna is going to start displaying some reaction right away. So putting the tuner in and using the tuner, these claims that, the antenna is so broadband, no tuner required. And really, I take that with a grain of salt. I have had very good results over the years of using the tuner, and I find no reason why that you can't have the tuner in the line. I don't know why some will claim, ridiculous claims about, antenna patterns and all that. I think that's all stuff that you hear sometimes 75 years, so outrageous that it's only paid to get into it. So that's the bottom line. You use the antenna tuner, put the cable between the antenna tuner, as much cable as you need, good quality cable up to the antenna and you're in business. So, anything else to add to this, Dick, before you want to go on with anything else? Want to try another one? K2RIW in the tech next, Steve.
K2GIW?
WB2HWW with a comment.
K2GIW?
QIW and HWW both recognized. I'm going to say a couple of other words. When you follow Mel's advice and ignore the people on 20 meters most of the time on this subject, you're probably doing the right thing. But if you happen to listen to them, almost any day of the week, you will find somebody on 20 meters or 10 meters or 40 meters telling you that an antenna tuner cheats. All it does is eat up the power that's being reflected from the antenna. And it makes the standing wave ratio look good, but the efficiency sucks when you do that. Ha. Huh. Of that 100 watts coming out of your transmitter, there's only three things that power going down the line can do. Number one, it can be radiated into space. That's good. Number two, it can be reflected back to the transmitter. and your standing wave ratio indicating device or your bird watt meter is going to tell you how much is going forward and how much is coming back. And number three, it can eat up that power that's reflecting back into heat by something getting hot. It can burn it up as heat. So there's only three things you can do with the power: radiate it, turn it into heat, or reflect it. And if when you properly use an antenna tuner, and so at the transmitter you don't see any reflected power, it ain't going there. If the antenna tuner is well shielded and it's not radiating, then it's not wasting the power. And if the antenna tuner doesn't get hot to the touch, it isn't eating up the power. You can have an antenna with a really bad 4-to-1 standing wave ratio. You can have a feed line that's reasonably low in loss. You can have a reasonable quality antenna tuner. That 4-to-1 standing wave ratio would be intolerable to your transmitter. He would trip out and either give you 1 watt of output or just go into the standby mode. You use that antenna tuner. The antenna tuner tells the transmitter it's only seeing a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio, and of the 100 watts you're producing with your transmitter, 98 of those watts are going to be radiated into space. The antenna tuner is capable of operating at near 100% efficiency. You say those words on 20 meters, you're going to get a whole lot of people climbing down your throat saying you're crazy, you don't know what you're talking about. You also tell those people that, hey, with my antenna tuner that's got enough range to it, I can have a transmission line that's long, short, and everything in between. And the antenna tuner will take out that reactant and retune the situation. You're going to get a whole lot of people telling you, if you don't have exactly an odd number of quarter wavelengths, an even number of half wavelengths, or some other old wives' tales, they think they're a specific length of cable that tune out the standing wave ratio. Pure hogwash, but lots of people believe it. Ain't true. If you've got a 50-ohm cable and you've got a 17-ohm antenna, you've got a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio, in Nell's example, 17-ohm resistive and 2.5 ohms reactant, you've got a nearly a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio, a certain percentage of the power, something like 1/3 of the power is reflecting back down that line, and whether the line is long or short, you're going to have that exact amount of power reflecting down that line. And once you use the antenna tuner, you re-reflect it forward, and you radiate into space. I know that sounds too good to be true. You study it enough, and I think you'll become a believer. It's a QIW. Start off with your name, sir, because I should know it, and then your comment, KQIW.
This is KT2QIW. His name is Joe.
Go ahead, Joe, with your comment.
Yeah, I just got in there like 20 minutes ago. I have a quick question.
Okay. We're going to go over to Howie for his comment on the subject on the floor, and then we're going to come back to your question. Howie, go ahead with your comment.
Yeah, I think you should simply say, use an antenna tuner because it will give you one benefit. It will act like a low-pass filter, and it will act like to clean up your second harmonic. So even if you have a 1-to-1 SWR, why not use an antenna tuner, and it's going to give you some added protection not to bother another service or give you or interfere with somebody else. It will also clean up, and it will also make your receiver work a little bit better because it's going to give you some filtering in the front end in both ways, both in receive and the transmit side, Dick.
Yeah, I like that. Modern-day transmitters that fit the FCC requirements have the second harmonic and all other undesired products 60 or 80 dB down, depending on the power out of the transmitter. So unless that neighbor is pretty darn close, hopefully he's somewhat protected from television interference from the harmonics of your transmitter. But yes, the antenna tuner definitely increases. It's another filter. It's a bandpass filter. And there are certain ways with a L-Pi type antenna tuner where you can make it act like a low-pass filter. And if you have access to a good spectrum analyzer, you can really analyze how much power on the second harmonic on TV channel 2 is coming out of your 28 megacycle antenna. It'd be nice to know that it is 84.5 dB down, but if that's still 10 dB above threshold to your neighbor's TV set, you may need something more. Move the antenna, put in another filter, put in the antenna tuner, properly tune it, look at it with a spectrum analyzer. What's a lot of fun to do with a spectrum analyzer is to look at all the harmonics coming out of a transmitter downrange from the antenna tuner while you're twiddling the knob on the antenna tuner. I've done that. It's a fun process. You can literally know each of those harmonics one at a time as you twiddle the knobs on the antenna tuner. And if you happen to know that one of your harmonics just happens to be bombing your neighbor's set on channel 2 or channel 4, you can tune your antenna tuner in such a way to know that particular component, to knock it down 100 dB. It's a fun process. And you're not violating any of the laws of physics when you do it, and you can still end up with 95% radiation efficiency of your whole system. That's part of what Howie is saying. So, Joe, KC2QYW, I think it is. Go right ahead, Joe. For the people who are not listening to the input like I am, Joe is asking us a question about a multi-antenna tuner. Joe, your PL tone is not there, and the machine at 11 o'clock flips over to the non-net mode, which means that...
Oh, I got it now.
Yes, you got it now. So why don't you repeat your question so everyone else can hear it. I heard it, but go ahead. Joe, that whole last transmission did not come through. The PL tone turned itself back off. Are you sure you got the antenna, the PL tone turned on? Okay, maybe your PL is turned on. Is the PL tuned to 4 Zulu, 136.5 Hertz of PL? Double check that right now, Joe. Okay, so far you're not coming through the machine, so even though you may have dialed in 136.5, are you sure it's really turned on? And it's got to be PL in code, on transmission, not just on reception, on transmission. It's unfortunate that what happened, just as Joe came on with his question, we went through 11 o'clock, the machine flipped over to the mode where it's got to have PL, and it's also got to have an interruption every 2 minutes to reset its timer. And so, just at that time, is when we passed it over, Joe. That's Murphy's Law. Any luck on getting that PL to go back on, Joe?
How about now? Check.
Now you've got it. Okay. So, to paraphrase what I think Joe is saying, he's about to put up a multi-band antenna that really covers 80, 40, 20, 15, 17, 10, and whatever. And he's asking, should he use an antenna tuner? And without a doubt, the antenna tuner is going to help. Does he absolutely have to have it? If the manufacturer of that antenna, or if the designer of that antenna, had really done his job so that it gives an extremely low standing wave ratio across the total width of every one of those bands, then yes, no antenna tuner would be required. But those words that I just said are almost beyond the laws of physics. Without doing some heroic work, you cannot make an antenna give you an extremely low standing wave ratio across all the frequencies of, for instance, 80 meters, 3.5 to 4.0 megacycles. Percentage-wise, that's a lot of bandwidth. And for an antenna to give you low visual across that whole band without you readjusting the antenna in some way every time you go to a new frequency, very unlikely. So do you need an antenna tuner, even though you've got an antenna that covers all of those bands? Without a doubt, it is beneficial. It is not a showstopper, but I recommend you do it. I wonder if that helps a little bit, Joe. Back to you, K2LAW. My name is Dick.
Yeah, Roger, Dick. I don't know if you guys told me about the dipole. My super over here, you might think a whole bunch of pigeons might hang out on the dipole if we make one up there. But then I said to him, how about a vertical? And he was saying that's my best bet. So Yeah, some of these radios have built-in antenna tuners, but I guess that's if I have one outside of the radio too, correct? Back to the net.
If you've got a real good transmitter receiver, transceiver, that has a built-in antenna tuner, most of those antenna tuners with a good design do the job very nicely. However, because they are limited in space inside that radio, because most of us want our radio to be super compact, and the manufacturer, you know, his marketing department told him that the rig will only sell if it occupies a very small fraction of a cubic foot. And so they try to squeeze as much jazz in there as they can get into that very small amount of space. And the bottom line might be an antenna tuner that is limited in its tuning range. Maybe it can match any phase angle of 3.5 to 1 standing wave ratio, but you give it a 4 to 1 standing wave ratio with a particular length of cable, and it runs out of range. And in that case, what's the solution? Well, you can put another random length of cable to bring it back into range. You're not changing the biswar. You're changing the phase angle of that biswar. And every antenna tuner can tune way beyond the magnitude the manufacturer told you. That antenna tuner built into that compact rig, the manufacturer tells you it'll tune every single phase angle of 3 to 1 or less. And to which you say, hey, I got a 5 to 1. If you give it the right phase angle, for all we know, it can go to a 9 to 1 standing wave ratio at the right phase angle. That's a particular length of cable. You're not changing the biswar. You're changing the phase angle of the biswar. And so if you plot it on the Smith chart where the antenna tuner will tune you, it is not a circle. It's a funny shaped elliptical-like thing where in certain phase angles, at certain angles on that Smith chart, in certain directions, maybe off at 1 o'clock, so to speak, on the Smith chart, is where the antenna tuner will tolerate at 8 to 1. And you can, if you're smart enough, you can fall into that region. So you don't necessarily have to use another antenna tuner on the outside because the one on the inside doesn't have enough range. But now when it comes to a dipole, and the super thinks that you'd be better off with a vertical because of the pigeon, I'm having trouble with this one. A dipole is an extremely simple, low-cost, very high-performance antenna. And if you're worried about the pigeon sitting on the dipole, I don't think they're going to do that. Pigeons will sit on something they can wrap their legs around, like the branch of a tree. They can grab onto it. A skinny little piece of wire, yeah, they can hold onto it, but they can't balance themselves on that. They're going to tip forward or tip back, and therefore their body's going to rotate. No matter how tightly they grip that piece of wire, the piece of wire is going to rotate with them. And it's not a comfortable thing to stand on. It's like a high wire rack. I don't think the pigeons are going to sit on your dipole. And if you think they are, I can give you the swiveling devices that are sold in any fishing shop where your monofilament line can twist itself, so to speak, on the swivel. You can put swivels on each end of the dipole so that the wire is capable of rotating. No self-respecting pigeon is going to sit on that wire when the wire can rotate because he can't keep himself balanced. He's doing a continuous high wire act. He's going to be continuously flapping his feathers. He's got his wings. He's going to get tired, and he's going to say, I don't like Joe's dipole. The hell with him. I ain't going to sit there. So, and on top of that, the ground plane antenna, let me drop a second. The ground plane antenna that your super is trying to talk you into is pretty big bucks. To make it work well requires a whole lot of ground plane radios. It's a fancy looking antenna. It's shiny. It's got doodads all over it. You're going to spend a lot of money. And you're going to hear an awful lot of people on this TechNet tell you from time to time, I use this whiz-bang, gold-plated, expensive ground plane antenna. I used it for a year, and it sort of worked. I threw a dipole up in the air with a slingshot, and boy, it worked a whole lot better. We've heard that story so often. So don't give up on the dipole, and stop thinking the pigeons are going to sit there. I hope I said something, and you know what I said. The pigeons are not going to sit on that wire. On the branch of a tree, yes. On your wire, no way. On the round elements of a television aerial, yes. They can get their grip on that, and they can balance themselves. On a skinny little piece of wire, I don't think any self-respecting pigeon is going to stay there for more than a couple of minutes. Back to you, Joe. KC2QIW, K2LIW.
Yeah, roger. Unless they join the circus there. Okay, let me go back to that built-in antenna tuner. I'm reading off the magazine here. It covers 160M to 6M. It says use dipole or, what is that, Yagi? Y-A-G-I antenna? Yeah, I'm listening to them, you know? Because the vertical, it'll warn me about two.
Excuse me, guys.
They warned me about 200 miles for that vertical one by Hustler. Back to the net. Sorry about the noise in the background.
Yeah, don't worry. We like the sound of kids. Yagi, Y-A-G-I, is Yagi, made by a guy in 1928 named Hindu Subu Yagi. That's the antenna that looks like a fishbone. A very high-performance antenna. But on HF frequencies, Yagi antennas are pretty damn big. The Super is going to be a little bit reluctant on that one. A good Yagi antenna with four elements on 20 meters, for instance, is, 30 feet long, something like that. He ain't gonna be happy with that great big monster on the roof of his building. A simple little dipole or trap dipole, multi-wire dipole, very easy. And I think the pigeons aren't gonna sit on it. So don't give up on the dipole, even though he thinks the pigeons are gonna sit there. In a very short order, you're gonna be able to prove to him no respecting pigeon is gonna sit on that wire. Of all the ham radio operators that Mel and I have ever talked to, I have never heard anyone complain that the birds sit on the wire of their dipole. Let me ask Mel on that one. Hey, Mel, you guys, you're a happy group of guys there in the Kings County Radio Club, of which you're the president of. I bet you've never heard anybody complaining about a simple wire dipole. The birds are sitting there and making a whole lot of droppings on the ground under the dipole. Have you ever heard anything like that? K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No, this is K2KEY. Now, I've got a loop antenna outside that's 272 feet square, and never saw a bird sit on it. But on the tower up there at 85 feet on the big beam up there, oh boy, crowds of birds at times. I mean, the whole family and their relatives are up there, and they make a bit of a mess sometimes. I remember to rotate the antenna so that the antenna is over the garden. This way, you know, they do their thing. It falls into the garden as fertilizer. But never saw them on the loop. That's plenty of wire for them to sit on. Never saw them. That's number 10 wire. no activity on the loop. But on the Aggie with those nice heavy elements, big boom and all, big plenty over.
I'm also remembering my sailboat enthusiasts. On the top of the mast of their sailboat, they've always got a spreader. And the birds love to sit on that spreader and put their droppings right on the top of the cabin of the sailboat. And so if you've got your beautiful varnished mahogany top of your sailboat on the top of the cabin, and these birds are putting their droppings on it, it's going to make you pretty unhappy. And people have tried all kinds of chemistry and sharp points and whatever. A very simple solution is to string a couple of wires above the spreader. The bird can no longer get his feet in between the wires and get onto the spreader. He's got to try to balance on the wires. And most of the time, the birds will not do that. It's a very simple solution. Put a couple of wires above the spreader. You don't have to use sharp spikes. You don't have to use chemistry. You don't have to use toxic substances. You don't have to use loud noises. Just a simple piece of wire. So the wire of your dipole is not a bird attractor. It is a bird repeller. I wonder if that makes sense to you, Joe. Go ahead.
Yeah, roger, roger. Makes a lot of sense. It's a very simple piece of wire, you know? And they also sell kits. I looked through the magazine, kits of it. End of September, I'm going to pick up an 8-7. Probably the FT-450.
Hi.
Okay, back to
the net. Hello, Amy. Sounds like she's going to become a ham radio operator later on in the show. Okay, if you want to, go to another one of the things in your mailbag. Let's go to one more, Raphael. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. Pretty good on that one. Let me look through. find something that I get into a big discussion or something. I'm looking for antenna, you know, questions. Yeah, a lot of questions about rigs, repairs, how do you go about it, and all. I can't really answer a lot of these particular. You know, I'm not there, you know, with test equipment and everything. How would you test troubleshooting? Let me put a word in it. You know, it is difficult on a lot of these new modern compact pieces of equipment to, you know, do really troubleshooting on them unless you've had experience in really working with, you know, electronics all along. It's not like years ago when Dick and I think we say we built our own rigs, and either the ones that you bought, they were chassis laid out with tubes, and you put the thing up on the side, you know, look at the bottom, you use a soldering gun and everything like that. See everything, look at everything. In fact, you can almost sometimes do a repair by just looking at physically what happened. But that's all gone, so I can't really tell you. Hear a number of questions about repairing the radio. An antenna question. About measuring gain. Oh my God, measuring gain. Is it similar to measuring efficiency? How the, you know, I see the antennas are advertised. Let me get this straight. I see the antennas are advertised, and they give, you know, gain measurement, gain of the antenna. And I'd like to know, can I in any way do the same test to confirm that the antenna I purchased has the gain that it was, sent by the manufacturer? I don't know. I don't think you can really give an answer to this thing, because I think a lot more than the average amateur radio has available to are real good, gain measurement, with the number of wavelengths and all that is really necessary in many cases, especially with HF antennas. You can do, of course, what Dick works with, he can do, you know, gain measurement. But for HF, they're referring here to HF antennas, you know, the gain, they most likely, you know, went to a number of manufacturers. He's trying to find which one has, you know, the published by these different manufacturers. For HF antennas, they're gain. He would like to know if he can, you know, actually, you know, test repeater.
Time out.
Repeater.
Time out. Cancel.
Okay, in order for an antenna to have gain, it must take up real estate. A simple half-wave dipole has an amount of gain. We call it decibels of gain over a dipole, usually 0 decibels. Unity performance, in other words, compared to a dipole. A halfway dipole will do that. As you make the dipole very, very small, but keep using a lossless antenna tuner, some form of impedance matching, you only lose half a dB as the antenna slowly goes to zero in length. I know that sounds crazy. You read the appropriate chapter of Krauss's book, one of the Bibles on the subject, the section on the infinitesimal dipole. You'll see it in black and white, published in 1950 by McGraw-Hill. And to this day, nobody has said that John Krauss is a liar and that he's dead wrong. There are lots of people who said, hey, I'm skeptical, that sounds crazy. But you go to a laboratory and test it, you say, wow, he's right. You only lose half a dB as the dipole gets really small. As the dipole starts getting larger, up to a 5/8 wave or whatever, in the case of a ground plane-like antenna mounted on top of an automobile, it picks up a dB and a half, 2 dB, something like that. You're really slowly converting your quarter-wave ground plane into a half-wave antenna. And where's the gain coming from? The fact that the antenna is higher off the roof of the car is where the majority of the gain is coming from. But as you go beyond the normal half wavelength in length and keep retuning it, or as you add other elements Mike, you make it a Yagi-like antenna. You put a director element, parasitic element in front called director, and another parasitic element behind called reflector. You're now chewing up more real estate. You're starting, your antenna structure is starting to take up a volume of space in wavelengths, and yes, now it has the capability of developing an antenna pattern, which you and I call gain. If it starts squirting all the power in one direction like a flashlight and taking it away from the other direction like a flashlight, that extra signal strength in the forward direction, we call it gain. So, manufacturers can make all kinds of crazy gain claims. In order to make their numbers sound better, they start including the reflection off the ground and calling that antenna gain. It's not exactly fair. It's in violation of the Antennas and Propagation Society definition. Their definition of gain is that which you measure in a
reflection
in a reflectionless environment, like an anechoic chamber, after you've removed all impedance mismatch. So, standing wave ratio is not part of gain. You first correct the standing wave ratio. You make sure the antenna is in an environment that has no reflection. That's what an anechoic chamber is. Anechoic means no echo. It's Greek. And so that's what you measure. That's traceable to the Bureau. It fits the definition of gain by the IEEE Antennas and Propagation Society, a peer-reviewed, worldwide respected society that defines these properties. And they have a dictionary of antenna terms, the IEEE dictionary of technical terms, and there's a special dictionary just for the antenna term, printed by the AP. So manufacturers have got all kinds of gain claims because they realize the average guy is about to spend a certain number of dollars, and if brand A says 3.1 dB of gain, and brand B says 3.2 dB of gain, and brand B is not more dollars than brand A, brand B is going to get more sales. The naive buyer thinks that that number is significant. It's a couple of tenths of a dB of difference between brand A and brand B displayed on a real signal strength meter of your receiver is something you're not going to see unless you put a magnifying glass on that signal strength meter. And you're not going to hear it coming out of that loudspeaker. Until the gain difference is a significant number of decibels, it almost doesn't matter on HF frequencies. When Mother Nature gives you that ionosphere, gives you that reflection, and you're operating a frequency that is below the maximum usable frequency for that particular pass, that ionosphere is enhancing your signal by 80 decibels. And here we are arguing about a couple of tenths or half or three quarters of a dB between brand A and brand B, and in many cases, it's a fifth. The ARRL will no longer accept an advertisement that has a gain claim in the advertisement because they 10, 15, 20 years ago realized the majority of the antenna manufacturers were fibbing. The gain of the antenna was not being set in the measurement laboratory. It was being set right in the middle of the advertising department. Some guy, you know, threw a dot against the wall, came up with a number, and said, this number will sell. We'll claim that in our advertisement. And nobody can easily confirm it, so we'll get away with it. Confirming the gain of your antenna by a real measurement is almost not worth the effort because the difference is so small, and second of all, the measurement is so difficult. You're way ahead of the game. If you really want to know the gain of your antenna, you make sure that it's made out of non-resistive components. In other words, the aluminum rods are not made out of carbon granules. It's real aluminum with real good contacts. And you know the dimensions you can measure with your ruler, with your tape measure, and you plug it into a computer program, it'll tell you what the gain of that antenna is. That's the quickest way you can measure the gain of the antenna. Model it on your computer program. But even that is, it's a nice experiment because you're an exacting scientist and you want to know. It's reasonably academic. When the band is open, the signals are 80 dB stronger than normal. when the band is closed, the signals are 80 dB weaker than you want them to be. Can you make up to 80 dB with your transmitter power and your antenna gain? No way in hell. A 10 megawatt transmitter with a 15 dB gain antenna ain't not going to hack it when the band is closed. And you're not going to contain the 15 dB gain antenna on your property unless you've got 15 acres to do it with. So, to a beginner, the gain of the antenna sounds important as all hell. You look at those antenna advertisements out of other magazines, and you think you're buying brand A and brand B depending on performance. So if there's raw performance, and you're buying it for that, you're doing something. The gain performance, most of the time, you're wasting your time. Wait until you're on the air with your simple beginner's antenna, and you're talking to your buddies, and you start hearing the good testimonials, and you find out that this guy, he homebrewed a four-element Yagi out of irrigation tubing and conduit tubing for the elements, and irrigation tubing for the mast, and because he bought it at a surplus shop, and it was scrap aluminum, and he didn't pay a whole lot of dollars, and he used some elbow grease and some craftiness, yes, he can come up with an antenna with pretty high performance, and you're going to see that antenna. It takes up real estate. So try not to be sucked up by these gain claims. To a beginner, it sounds important. It's not. It's show. It's facade. 98% of it is not real. You make a decision that, hey, I've got the right facilities in my backyard. Let me drop a second. I've got a tree that's tall enough. I've got a tower that's tall enough. I'm putting up a pole that's tall enough. I can put my dipole high enough up in the air that I'm going to get the right performance. Start off with the dipole. Damn hard to beat a piece of wire as a dipole. It's got very little visibility. The neighbors will never see it. Only ham operators are going to see it. And you get a lot of performance with very little dollars. Start off with that. Get on the air. Talk to your buddies. Listen to their testimonials. Find out what transmitters, what feed line, what antenna tuner, and what antennas they're using. And consider copying them. And if you start off as a beginner looking at the catalogs and trying to choose the right brand of antenna, you're being sucked into a show. It's almost not real. That's my opinion. K2KUI, K2RIW.
Amen.
Hey, very good. This is K2KUI. Yep. Some years ago, I attended a amateur radio get-together they had in Washington. And the speech at that time was a guy by the name of Carl Mosley, the owner of Mosley Antennas. And he was really quite irate about it, really upset, to say the least, because at that time QSC and the other magazines were still publishing figures, antenna gain figures, and of course he was losing business galore, because like Dick just said, sometimes they came up with the antenna figure, they took a dot board, threw the dot wherever it landed, oh, that's a great figure. They were making all kinds of claims for their antennas. Some of them would go as far as, you know, showing that they have a dipole kit that they sold, and compare it to somebody's Yagi, and show that the dipole had more gain than the Yagi. And Carl Mosley finally, he challenged. He gave them all a challenge at the time. He said, I have an antenna test range. My antennas are tested at 10 wavelengths. They are also a minimum of a half wavelength above ground. And he says that he was very irate when he said, they're all a bunch of bunk. They are making any kind of statement. They look at one another's advertisements. You claim, 8 dB gain. The next one claims 9 dB, and on and on and on, and some of them had such claims that, if you want to relay, there was a guy that I knew quite well. He was producing a two-element, four-shortened 20-meter beam, compact beam, and he was claiming 12 feet gain. So it got out of hand. That's why...